Okay, we'd like to make a start again, please. So I'd just like to draw attention to an observation that Wally had just as we went for tea. We had this phrase from Rilke's first elegy that we are not really at home in our interpreted world. And Leonard brought up a good question about what was meant by interpreted. And Wally said to me that what we just read from the letters, letter five, talking about the impressions in Rome. Would you like to tell us, Wally, what you saw? There's the microphone for Wally there.
It just struck me that in the letter we have Rilke saying, through such impressions one collects oneself, and then particularly wins oneself back again out of the pretentious multiplicity that talks and chatters there. And I guess, to me, the idea of winning yourself back out of something which is not you,
yep,
sounds like this phrase, the interpreted world.
That's right. I think that's a really interesting observation, that winning oneself back out of the pretentious multiplicity that talks and chatters, and one learns slowly to recognize the very few things in which the eternal endures. You know, how easily we get drawn back into that talkative world. I think D.H. Lawrence says something about the talkative world as well, somewhere in St. Moore or somewhere. It just rings a bell for me.
The Buddhists, like, the Buddhists talk about the monkey mind, and there's this sort of that monkey mind. That's way around. There's the thoughts that come and go and that have no rhyme or reason to them, often stray thoughts that we don't even notice. But there is something deeper also that's possible to uncover.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's exactly where I think Rilke is heading. Yep.
And it reminds me of the interior castle. You know, the first castle where you get rid of all the snakes, etc.
Yep.
That are in your mind.
Yep.
But more contemporarily, the whole exercise of focusing to bring people into to meditative states.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. Yep. Absolutely. Thank you. So there's more, certainly I'd like you to, I've got many more passages in these letters marked here, but I'll let you read those letters yourselves, and feel free, like next week, you know, after you've studied the document more, to bring thoughts and ideas and questions from what you've read. It doesn't have to be all from me. You know, I'm not saying that it would be better if it was all from you, but it's good to have a sense that you can own whatever you want and can lead the discussion in whatever direction you want. And just before I forget, I put on your chairs, I put this kind of simplified guide for the elegies and the sonnets, which is from eNotes, which is a very useful, I use this site very much for my own teaching. It says on the top here, no part of this work covered by copyright may be reproduced. But just to give you security, I actually have an email here from the people who produced it saying I have full permission to produce this for this seminar. So that covers me as well. Let's turn to the sonnets to Orpheus. on page 29 to begin with. Now, the sonnets to Orpheus were written like at the end of Rilke having written the 10 Duino elegies. The 10 Duino elegies are sometimes seen as the kind of the 10 commandments of Moses. They have that kind of seriousness, solemnity about them, dramatic, filled with pain and angst and doubt. They've been compared to T.S. Eliot's four quartets. I think it would be a wonderful study to look at the four quartets and the Duino elegies together. It would be absolutely fantastic.
Next year.
give me 2 years. The sonnets to Orpheus were produced almost like a shout of joy after the completion of the 10 elegies. He wrote to Luz Salome Andreas. He wrote to her ecstatically about having finished the elegies and then having started the sonnets to Orpheus. Sonnets to Orpheus, in their texture, in their feel, in their mood, dramatically different from the elegies, but they almost fit together as a composite work that fulfilled, you know, two halves or many halves of Rilke's whole psyche. Pictures here on the screen. 1922 was the completion of the elegies, and it was in 1922 that he began, and in 1923 finished the sonnets to Orpheus. And where he finished them, where he wrote them, was in that little castle there in Muzo in Switzerland. And he'd spent some time in Spain. He travelled a lot. We'll talk a little bit more about his travelling. But he came to Switzerland in 1922 and looked for a girlfriend and looked up an old artist friend of his. And of course, they fell passionately in love. And Merlin is her name. She helped Rilke find this castle. It was, I think, advertised in a butcher shop in the local village, unused. And she went and helped him set it up. And he lived there pretty well till the end of his life. He died pretty young, in his early 50s. But it was here in this castle that he wrote the sonnets to Orpheus. The stimulus to the sonnets to Orpheus, if you look on the top of page 29, it says, geschrieben als ein Grabmal für Vera Ukma Knub. And there's a little bit of background information here that's worth noting. Vera Ukma Knub was a 19-year-old girl who died of some terrible disease that affected the glands of her body. When she was 16, she was a dancer, and she got this glandular fever. She became ever heavier and bigger and could not move. She became then, instead of a dancer, she became a painter, and eventually she just drew things. And Rilke was very touched by this death. The reason he was particularly touched is that she had been a school friend of his daughter. They'd been to school together, the daughter that he'd abandoned. Rilke's abandonment of his daughter is a difficult thing to swallow in some ways. But one has to know his whole life and the circumstances and conditions to make any judgments about this. I'm very loath to make any judgment about anybody's life. He wrote a letter to Vera Knoop's mother, and this is a paragraph from the letter. Now this is what he says. This is just a paragraph from the letter that he wrote to the mother. That suffering is an error. A dull misapprehension arising from the physical that drives its wedge, its stony wedge, into the unity between heaven and earth. And, at the other extreme, the oneness of her wide open heart with the existing and enduring world, this ascent to life, this joyous, impassioned communing to the very last moment with her native earth. He was sort of deeply impressed by the fact that despite her gradual sickness, this 19-year-old would move from one kind of art expression to another. She never let go. This very last moment with her native earth. Ah, with only the earth? Nay, and this she could not know in these first attacks of breakup and parting. With the whole, with much more than the earth. Oh, how she loved, how she reached out with the antenna of her heart beyond all that can be grasped or encompassed here. Now, the other thing that is just worth mentioning for both the Duino elegies and for the sonnets to Orpheus is that Rilke was deeply interested in, passionately interested in, the connection between life and death. This for him was a kind of a deep preoccupation. He could not see death as final. This is where the Orpheus myth kind of fits very much into his whole thinking. Orpheus, you remember, was the son of Apollo, master magician, able to animate nature with his song. And when his wife Eurydice died, he obtained her release from the underworld on the condition that he would not look at her until they reached the upper world. But he could not resist glancing back at her at the last moment. Legend had it that he was subsequently dismembered by Thracian women and scattered throughout the universe until all of nature became his song. And in the Dura painting on the right there, Orpheus slain, are the Thracian women about to dismember Orpheus. Very close to Christianity, its underlying myth. And this introduced a second phase about Orpheus, during which Orpheus became the religious centre of a Dionysian sect and presided in his magical divinity over the ancient religious mysteries of Greece. And Sonnets to Orpheus incorporates this second magical aspect of the god. Now, this book here, Stephen Mitchell's translations of the Duino elegies and the sonnets to Orpheus, Stephen Mitchell, is one of the best little books. If you really want to pursue this more, then I can recommend Stephen Mitchell's translations. And it's an annotated translation. Every difficult part of the sonnets and the elegies are supplemented by letters from Rilke to various people, where he's talking in prose about the content. This is what Rilke had to say about the sonnets to Orpheus in 1923, writing to Countess Margot Sisso Norris Krui. He knew a lot of countesses and princesses, did Rilke. He was certainly up there. But you know, his life was a mixture of extreme highs and extreme lows. He was like on the streets of Paris for years. And then he met people, he met Rodin and met Louis-Andrés Salomé. I mean, it's quite an amazing sort of ricochet life that he had. Here is Rilke talking about his sonnets to Orpheus. These strange sonnets were no intended or expected work. They appeared, often many in one day. The first part of the book, 25 sonnets, was written in about 3 days. Completely unexpectedly, in February of last year, when I was, moreover, about to gather myself for the continuation of those other poems, the great Duino elegies. He'd started the elegies back in 1912 in Duino Castle. He'd finished the first two completely, and he'd begun a number of other ones, including the ninth one that we're going to be looking at next week, and maybe read it today. I could do nothing but submit purely and obediently to the dictation of this inner impulse. And I understood only little by little the relation of these verses to the figure of Vera Knoop, that's this 19-year-old girl who died, whom I hardly knew and saw only a few times in her life when she was still a child, though with extraordinary attention and emotion. Without my arranging it this way, except for a few poems at the beginning of the second part, all the sonnets kept the chronological order of their appearance. It happened that only the next to last poems of both parts explicitly refer to Vera, address her or evoke her figure. This beautiful child, who had just begun to dance and attracted the attention of everyone who saw her by the art of movement and transformation which was innate in her body and spirit, unexpectedly declared to her mother that she no longer would or could dance. This happened just at the end of childhood. Her body changed, grew strangely heavy and massive without losing its beautiful Slavic features. This was already the beginning of the mysterious glandular disease that later was to bring death so quickly. During the time that remained to her, Vera devoted herself to music. Finally, she only drew, as if the denied dance came forth from her ever more quietly, ever more discreetly. And it's worth here just commenting on the fact that Rilke asked Merlin to bring him a big exercise book so he could write the sonnets on one page and write his comments on the other page, because he didn't understand his own poems. And he says here to Clara Rilke, his wife, "I myself have only now little by little comprehended them and found a way to pass them on. With brief comments that I insert when I read them aloud, I am able to make the whole more intelligible. Interconnections are established everywhere, and where a darkness remains, it's the kind of darkness that requires not clarification, but surrender." And I'm just reminded here of what David Maloof, who comes to see my students annually at the Catholic University, said to a student a few weeks ago. A student asked a question about what he meant by the title of Fly Away Peter and how that fitted into the novel. And David Maloof said, "I'm sorry, but I do not understand my own novels. You have to tell me what they mean. I just wrote them." And, you know, he talked there in that context, he talked about how writing brings you into touch with a different part of your being, a different part of your brain. And, you know, it is often as if something is coming out of you from the non-rational part of your mind. So we're not unfamiliar with this idea, but perhaps with Rilke it's stronger. So we're looking at the first sonnet in the first part of the sonnets to Orpheus. And these first sonnets, 1, 2 and 3, in a sense they bring the myth of Orpheus into focus. And this image here by the Renaissance artist Cima de Conegliano was seen by Rilke in his travels to Florence. Lou Andrea Salome, she actually insisted that Rilke go to Florence and look at Florentine art before he went to Russia, and he went there. And this particular painting perhaps helps to understand this first sonnet. There you've got a young Orpheus sitting at the foot of a tree with his lyre, and you can see how the tree is reaching up above him, and the animals are coming out of their grottos, their cells, coming towards him with the the sound of the lyre. And the bottom corner, I've got Marsilio Ficino, who was a great Renaissance philosopher, who was celebrated as the embodiment of Orpheus, there holding, presented in a sculpture, holding his Orphic harp. There's more to be talked about that later. And there's a sense in which this first poem is actually an ekphrastic poem. What is an ekphrastic poem? Who knows? Anybody know? An ekphrastic poem is a poem that is written in direct response to a work of art, to a painting, like a literal translation of a painting or a sculpture. And there are quite a lot of Rilke's poems that are ekphrastic. Ekphrastic.
How do you spell that word?
Oh, sorry. There, you got it?
Yep. A bit sharper.
So I think we're going to look at this first sonnet, and I'm going to make sure that we read the ninth elegy before we finish, so that we can go away with a bag of things that we can ponder on between now and next week. Okay, I'm going to read it in German first. Da stieg ein Baum, o reine Übersteigung, o Orpheus singt, o hoher Baum im Ohr, und alles schwieg, doch selbst in der Verschweigung ging neuer Anfang, Wink und Wandlung vor. Tiere aus Stille drangen aus dem klaren, gelösten Wald von Lager und Genist, und da ergab sich, dass sie nicht aus List und nicht aus Angst in sich so leise waren, sondern aus Hören. Brüllen, Schrei, Geröhr schien klein in ihren Herzen. Und wo eben kaum eine Hütte war, dies zu empfangen, ein Unterschlupf aus dunkelstem Verlangen, mit einem Zugang, dessen Pfosten beben, da schufst du ihnen Tempel im Gehör. So, Orpheus is a spiritual presence that has the capacity to transform inanimate to animate, the capacity to bring wild animals out in connection. You know, the myth of St. Francis here is not irrelevant. An archetypal inspired singer, able to charm all living things with his music. This in the context of a series of sonnets dedicated for this young 19-year-old who has died. So let's read the English translation. There the tree rises. O pure surpassing. O Orpheus sings. O great tree of sound. And all is silent. And from this silence arise new beginnings, intimations, changings. From the stillness animals throng out of the clear, snapping forest of lair and nest. And thus they are stealthy, not from cunning, not from fear, but to hear. And in their hearts the howling, the cry, the stag-like call seem too little. And where before was but the rudest shelter to receive these, a refuge fashioned out of darkest longing, entered tremulo, the doorpost a-quiver. There you have fashioned them a temple for their hearing. So now how to kind of attune oneself to the mythic dimension of a figure like Orpheus for the 20th century. What does this poem enact in terms of its relationship to inner reality? What, you know, one can stumble upon all the things that kind of stand in the way of logical, rational understanding. There's so much in this poem that seems kind of counterintuitive or doesn't seem to kind of lead anywhere. So how to open oneself to what's being dramatized almost like on an internal stage, because the suggestion is that, you know, Orpheus is no longer alive, but his spirit is animatable, and Rilke is attuning himself to the power and the nature of this myth. Let me read it again in German and then we'll share a few thoughts about it. Da stieg ein Baum. There grows a tree. O reine Übersteigung. O pure transcendence. Metanoia. O Orpheus singt. O hoher Baum im Ohr. O Orpheus is singing. O high tree in the ear. Und alles schwieg. And everything is still. Doch selbst in der Verschweigung ging neuer Anfang, Wink und Wandlung vor. Yet still in the intense stillness, something was happening. Soft movements, beckoning. Movement, transformation, Wandlung. Tiere aus Stille drangen aus dem klaren, gelösten Wald von Lager und Genist. It's a really important line here. We've got animals out of the stillness being freed into the clear. Gelösten is dissolved. Something's dissolved. Something is open. Wood. And dissolved from their Lager und Genist, from their hiding, from their nest. Things are opening up. Und da ergab sich, dass sie nicht aus List und nicht aus Angst in so sich leise waren, sondern aus Hören. And there it happened that it wasn't out of craftiness or not out of fear that they had been so quiet, but it was because they'd been hearing something. Sondern aus Hören. Brüllen, Schrei, Geröhr, schien klein in ihren Herzen. Screaming, shouting, noise, everything dimmed down to stillness in their hearts. Und wo eben kaum eine Hütte war, dies zu empfangen, ein Unterschlupf aus dunkelstem Verlangen, mit einem Zugang, dessen Pfosten beben, da schufst du ihnen Tempel in Gehör. And where before there had not even been a kind of a hut, to capture this whole movement, there was a refuge created out of the darkest longing, with an entry, with posts next to it, there created in the temple of their hearing. Don't all speak at once.
Well, I think Francis.
Yeah, please, yeah, go there. Carol, yeah, turn it on.
Yeah, I think of Francis in all this.
Yep.
You know? And how, well, I'm a lay Franciscan, so.
Okay, you know all about it, yep.
Yeah, it feels like it. It feels like Francis.
Yeah.
And wolves and birds and, you know, all kinds of creatures coming.
Coming. Uh-huh. Being opened. Uh-huh. Beautiful, yep, lovely. Yes, Heather, pass the microphone round.
What came to me in that last one was this whole idea of the refuge that's built being like an echo chamber.
Right.
Sort of something that's surrounded it so the sound could be reverberated.
Right. Yeah, right.
So the building was the reason for it was to accentuate and to center the sound.
Right, beautiful. Yep. Very good. Any other thoughts or comments? So there's something really important about the way that Orpheus's music instills life into the trees, the stones, the animals, and breaks down the rigid forms of nature. There's something there, there's a kind of a catalytic force through his acoustic and visual interchange, this breaking down of rigid forms that comes through in the second line of the second stanza in the English translation. It doesn't really come out as well as in the German. It says here in English, from the stillness, animals throng out of the clear snapping forest. In the German, it's the animals are pushing themselves out of the stillness into the clear, dissolved, opened wood out of their previous refuges. Please, yep, Mari.
That poem, more than anything else, showed me how the importance of listening to it in the journey, because you've got a richness there in the, as you say, the cadence and so forth.
Yep.
And as you translate it, like with the dissolving and so forth, it's softer translation.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Thanks for that, Mari. Please, yes, Leonard.
Can I just ask you, like, when you're giving your English words compared to the one that's on the paper, is that sort of like the license that we have in the translation?
That
like
is.
You're trying to transmit something yourself, aren't you?
That's right. And I have the luxury of not having to force it into a poetic form. That's the difference, because, you know, someone who's writing a poetic translation, they have to say, well, how can I do justice to this? I've got to keep the same stanzas. Maybe I have to keep rhymes, surpassing, changings, clear, fear. So there's always limitations on the words that they can choose, whereas a literal prose translation can often be truer to the meaning of the word, but it's a struggle to kind of get that into a poetic form that works. That's why, you know, some translations, as Carol has mentioned, can be dead, and others of them can bring some life to it. I mean, this is the real challenge you've got with dealing with any poet in translation. We've got to work ahead of us in the next few weeks. We've really got to knuckle down, and I'd certainly like you to read all the sonnets to Orpheus that we've got here in the English translation, obviously. Read the notes that I've given you. Do any other research you want to about Rilke. There's so much stuff out there on Google about Rilke. You get trapped by it all. And I want to, next week, make an attempt at taking us into the Ninth Elegy. Now, I've got a note here that in the Ninth Elegy, this picks up very much what we read in the letters and what we read in one of the early poems we looked at. For Rilke, the poetic word, that is the saying of things, emerges as the chief vessel and vehicle of the great task of transformation. I don't know where I got that from, but that resonated with me as to what Rilke is trying. The saying of things emerges as the chief vessel and vehicle of the great task of transformation. Now, personally, this is something that really interests me and has done ever since I've been studying English literature and German literature. That's the relationship between words and the truth, and stillness and the truth. And Rilke is somewhere between. Like, I practice meditation, and in meditation I work hard at freeing myself from words. And I trust the states that come with meditation. And for me, that's certainly part of my spiritual path. At the same time, I find T.S. Eliot and Rilke in their struggles with language to reach the place of stillness, I find that fascinating. It's like, you know, what is it in the human creative mechanism that uses words to kind of disengage from language? It's really interesting. I mean, one of the key phrases that I keep throwing at my students is from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, where he says, words reach into the silence. And, you know, in the Four Quartets, he describes his own struggle with words, the way that words kind of dissolve and get in the way. And it's a fascinating question. And I suppose it relates to the whole question of human creativity. Painting, dancing, music, all these are human ways of articulating a way towards something beyond the kind of materiality of the earth. Or is it? Or is it a new way of embracing the materiality? So it's a big question. For me, it's a really interesting question. The year after next, this is a big flag I'm flying. This year we had a conference at ACU with Lawrence Freeman, and the conference was called Awakening the Sacred. In 2019, I've got Lawrence Freeman coming again. We'll be doing a conference called Sacred Silence in Literature and the Arts. Now, he's giving a paper on Rothko, who's an abstract artist who is dealing with abstract forms as a way of creating spaces of stillness. So that's in October 2019. Put it in your calendar. I want to read to you now the ninth elegy. Bearing in mind what I've just said here, in the ninth elegy, the poetic word, the saying of things, emerges as the chief vessel and vehicle of the great task of transformation.
What page?
It is page 20. There are some images that come from the things that inspired the Duino elegies. He spent some time in Toledo in Spain, and he was particularly taken by that painting in the top left-hand corner. He spent time in Islamic Spain and also down in Algeria. He was deeply inspired by Muhammad and Muhammadan religion. He knew a lot about Michelangelo. Rilke had this amazing capacity to sort of absorb all these cultural and spiritual directions and bring them into his work.
And what about the flamingos?
The flamingos is one of his... He's written a poem, you have it in here, The Flamingos. It's one of his Dingedichte, inspired by Rodin. Rodin told him to go into the garden... The zoo in Paris, the Jardin des Plantes, and he was so taken by the flamingos. You read his poem, The Flamingos, fantastic. So, it's too long. Sorry, Margaret.
I only think of flamingos as being in Australia.
Oh, right. I don't know if we do have flamingos in Australia. I think we have them in the zoos in Australia, but not as native birds. Okay, here we go. I'm going to read it in English, and then I might read a little bit in... If anybody has to leave at the dot of 12, I won't put a black note mark against your name. My fault that we're running a bit late. The ninth elegy. Why, if it could begin as laurel and be spent so, this space of being, a little darker than all the surrounding green, with little waves at the edge of every leaf, like a breeze's smile... Why then have to be human, and shunning destiny, long for destiny? Oh, not because happiness exists, that overhasty profit from imminent loss, not out of curiosity or to practice the heart which could exist in the laurel, but because being here is much, and because all that's here seems to need us, the ephemeral, that strangely concerns us. We, the most ephemeral, once for each thing, only once, once and no more, and we too, once, never again. But this once, to have been, though only once, to have been an earthly thing seems irrevocable. And so we keep pushing on and trying to achieve it, trying to contain it in our simple hands, in the overflowing gaze and the speechless heart, trying to become it. Whom to give it to? We would hold on to it forever. Ah, what, alas, do we take into that other dimension? Not the gazing, which we slowly learned here, and nothing that happened. Nothing. Suffering, then. Above all, then, the difficulty, the long experience of love. Then, what is wholly unsayable? But later, among the stars, what use is it? It is better unsayable. Since the traveller does not bring a handful of earth from mountain slope to valley, unsayable to others, but only a word that was one, pure, a yellow and blue gentian. Are we here perhaps for saying house, bridge, fountain, gate, jug, fruit tree, window, at most, column, tower? But for saying... Realize, oh, for a saying such as the things themselves would never have profoundly said. Is not the secret intent of this discreet earth to draw lovers on, so that each and everything is delight within their feeling? Threshold. What is it for two lovers to be wearing their own threshold of the ancient door a little? They too, after the many before them, and before those to come. Simple. Here is the age of the sayable. Here is its home. Speak and be witness. More than ever, the things of experience are falling away, since what ousts and replaces them is an act with no image. An act under a crust that will split as soon as the business within outgrows it and limit itself differently. Between the hammers, our heart lives on as the tongue between the teeth that in spite of them keeps praising. Praise the world to the angel, not the unsayable. You can't impress him with glories of feeling in the universe where he feels more deeply. You are a novice. So show him a simple thing, fashioned in age after age, that lives close to hand and in sight. Tell him things. He'll be more amazed, as you were, beside the rope maker in Rome, or the potter beside the Nile. Show him how happy things can be, how guiltless and ours, how even the cry of grief decides on pure form, serves as a thing or dies into a thing, transient. They look to us for deliverance. We, the most transient of all, will us to change them completely in our invisible hearts into, oh, endlessly, into us, whoever in the end we are. Earth, is it not this that you want? To rise invisibly in us? Is that not your dream, to be invisible one day, earth invisible? What is your urgent command, if not transformation? Earth, beloved, I will. Oh, believe me, you need no more springtimes to win me. Only one, our one, is already more than my blood can stand. Namelessly, I have been truly yours from the first. You are always right, and your most sacred inspiration is that familiar death. See, I live. On what? Neither childhood nor future grows less. Excess of being wells up in my heart. Now I'm going to read just a little bit in German, not the whole. Or should I read the whole? No? Seriously. Die neunte Elegie. Warum, wenn es angeht, also die Frist des Daseins hinzubringen als Lorbeer, ein wenig dunkler als alles andere Grün, mit kleinen Wellen an jedem Blattrand, wie eines Windes Lächeln. Warum dann Menschliches müssen und Schicksal vermeidend sich sehnen nach Schicksal? Oh, nicht, weil Glück ist, dieser voreilige Vorteil eines nahen Verlusts, nicht aus Neugier oder zur Übung des Herzens, das auch im Lorbeere wäre, aber weil hier sein viel ist und weil uns scheinbar alles das Hiesige braucht, dieses Schwindende, das seltsam uns angeht, uns, die Schwindesten. Einmal, jedes, nur einmal, einmal und nicht mehr, und wir auch einmal, nie wieder, aber dieses einmal gewesen zu sein, wenn auch nur einmal irdisch gewesen zu sein, scheint nicht widerrufbar. Und so drängen wir uns und wollen es leisten, wollen es enthalten in unseren einfachen Händen, im überfüllteren Blick und im sprachlosen Herzen. That's it. That's as far as we got. So I'll read the whole lot to you in German next week. But by next week, you will have had time to read the sonnets, read a bit more of the ninth elegy, make some sense of it. And we will, by the end of 4 weeks, we'll be comfortable with Rilke. And we'll even be comfortable with the elegies. And we won't think it's totally incomprehensible. That's my promise. But you have to do a little bit of work on the way. And you can do a creative exercise, and you can read as much as you wish. Thank you all. Thank you. Yeah.
I'm going to say in German, thanks, mate.
Dankeschön.
Dankeschön. I don't know about the mate. Dankeschön, Fritz. Maybe.
Michael, if I make just one more comment.
Please, yep.
And one is, when you were talking about the difference between going into silence and articulating it, I can remember, you know, Wittgenstein saying the limits of your language is the limits of your mind.
Ah.
And a fellow called Lacan, when I was
being Lacan,
to
yeah.
do counselling, he said that the structure of your language is the structure of the psyche.
Right.
Now, I think that's very akin what you were talking about there, the difference between...
Yeah, the structure of your language is akin to the structure of your psyche.
Yes.
That's really interesting.
And therefore, in counselling, we were always told to listen to the language, to the distortions, the distractions, and the generalisations.
You're right.
And get them to expand them.
Wow.
And allow them to self-direct.
Yep.
Because if they... You can't tell them anything. You've got to awaken what's there.
Very interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting. So we have more discussion about that. And what Zen silence means, and are they, in Zen silence, are you completely disassociated from the structures of your language psyche, or does that embed the silence that comes? This is question. Question. No answer required. John, thank you. Those words that I... Which ones?
The ones you got them off your phone.
Oh, the ones I got off my phone. Is this here?
Oh, a few of you can say it's why, but don't do any more than just your own.